Good morning. It's 8:17. Well, our first guest this morning on the local news hour, I've got Candace Hart, Snyderville planner, in here at the in the studio to give us an update. And I've also got Thomas Cook on the line. Good morning, Thomas. Are you there?
I am.
Hi there. Okay, so you both are here to talk about the recommended plan that was made last month by the Planning Commission to talk about moderate income housing. And this is a plan that has to be submitted to the state, I guess that was by yesterday, the 1st of December. Candace, why don't you first start off and tell us what this is all about and why it's going to the state?
Sure. And just for a couple points of clarification, the plan was actually created by the county, not by the Planning Commission. It was required by the state, and it's already passed the Planning Commission and went to County Council and was passed and approved by the County Council as well. So the plan itself essentially outlines what the needs are and what our approach is to that.
Okay. And so can you talk a little bit about what your concerns or issues are with the plan, if you have any at all?
Yeah, I don't know that I would characterize it as concerns. I would say, you know, when you think about affordable housing, or even putting that aside for a moment, you just think about our community as a whole. And that's a very important topic and issue for all of us, obviously, is we're growing and we continue to grow, and we're very concerned, and we really want to take care of our community as it does build out. And when it relates to something like affordable housing, that's a really important piece. So it's one thing to say we need affordable housing, but then what does that look like, and how do we incorporate that and let the affordable housing become part of the community in a way that looks and feels right to us? And I think some of the questions and conversations we've had have been around that. I mean, and sort of the hot word is integration, and the question comes down to, like, what does integration mean to somebody? And it seems to mean different things to different people. And so these are some of the things that we're still working through, and we kind of work through this on individual projects, and we work through it on this particular piece right here that went to council.
So can I get a little clarification on what moderate income housing is as compared to affordable housing, or are they basically the same thing?
Well, I think sometimes for the layperson, to most of us out there on the street, we kind of use them interchangeably. Essentially, what they do is they look at, you know, the average medium income, and then they say, okay, look, you know, we have a need for people that are 80% of average medium income, or 60% or below. And they have these, like, categories. And so when they're looking at affordable housing, they'll say, like, okay, at 80% AMI, we need X amount of for sale units and X amount of rentals. And they do that for each one of these categories. And not surprisingly, every single time they do one of these studies, we have needs at all of them. So it's in real simple terms, we need affordable housing, we need it for sale, and we need it for rent, and we need it at all price points.
Okay, Thomas, let's talk a little bit with you now about, my understanding is your father built housing.
Yeah, that's correct. In the, I'd say, late 60s, early 70s, my father developed affordable housing projects for HUD, and in conjunction with the Catholic Church, who owned the land back in Stamford, Connecticut. So as a little boy, I sort of grew up around the projects. I don't want to say project. That word is,
that's,
you know,
a loaded
I don't
word.
Want to say housing project, but project as in building the buildings and then managing them. So I guess it gives me some perspective, although, you know, Stamford, Connecticut in the 70s and Park City, Snyderville Basin in the, you know, mid-2000s are two very different places.
Yeah, sure. So is there still HUD housing financing available?
Well, you know, this is something that we experience on the Planning Commission, and we I can speak for myself and the other planning commissioners, we're learning more about, but there are some programs, you know, we commonly hear developers that are looking to build affordable housing talk about LIHTC or low-income housing credits, and my understanding is those are actually it's federal funding, but it's in the form of of how the loans for the projects are financed, and it's actually administered through the state. And so I believe it's a HUD program, but it's, Candace, maybe you could help me.
Well, I was just going to say that it's interesting when you get into the financing, because this seems to be, like, when you look at the, I don't know, the puzzle, if you will, of affordable housing, you know, the key piece for most of these developers is how are they going to pay for it? And how profitable can they be while developing their project, right? I mean, that's usually what makes or breaks. And I think most people would be happy to build it if they could do it and make money at it. So they usually go for some form of tax credits, and the financing becomes the key driver to them as to what they do. We'll often see a project that maybe comes through as an apartment, and then they switch it over to condos because they say they can't get the financing, and we're out of the loop. Like, we don't know what's driving some of these decisions. Sometimes, you know, they'll come before us, and one developer may say, you know, we just couldn't get that tax credit or that financing, and so now we have to switch it to condos. If it had was going to be apartments, where another developer comes through and seems to have no problem doing it. So I think it depends on what they're looking to get out of it. And what's presented to us is often sort of one side of that equation. But I would say that there's multiple ways to finance it. There's definitely, as Thomas is talking about, different tax credits and loan structures. But that seems to be the key to how much affordable housing gets built and when and how.
Okay, so this plan that was sent to the state last month, that was created by the county council, what does it mean now? I mean, what did the plan entail?
Well, Thomas, jump in here too. I mean, the plan basically just outlines the need, and you know, I mean, it says more than this, obviously, but for the, without boring everybody who's listening right now, it really identifies the need, and it talks about our approach to it, and you know, I think the only sort of two big open areas are essentially what the mechanism is that developers will use to pay for this, to create this affordable housing. I mean, as an extreme example, if you took that list and it has by unit how much you need in rentals and for sale units, and we decided we were going to build one giant building that met all of that needs, you could knock off the numbers fairly easily, but then you'd have this big building that nobody wants, and you know, nobody that lives there would want it. Nobody in the community would want it. So clearly there's a threshold to what we're willing to accept. We don't want it to stand out. And so really then it's like, okay, how do you get this affordable housing? And we talk about integration, and part of that is going to come through simply as projects are coming before the Planning Commission, the council, projects that are going to be built, is how much affordable housing do they put into it? And is that integration, as it gets spread around project to project, is integration mean, like, you know, you don't want to be able to point to the building and say that's the building of the affordable housing. Rather, it's just blended in with people paying full price. And, you know, honestly, the answer is different for different people. Some people see it as, look, you know, people don't care. The needs, right now we need it, let's just build it. And other people want to blend it. And this is some of the nuance in which, you know, we get caught up in. But one of the interesting things is you only get this affordable housing by building something new. And one of the things that we as a community react to is obviously density, right? Like this idea of new building and traffic we talk about. And so we're in a bit of a bind in every project we look at. We want affordable housing. We need affordable housing. But you only get it by building something new.
Okay, so integration, when you use that term, you are talking about integrating affordable housing with regular market-based housing.
Yeah, well, that's the part probably within the Planning Commission, you'll get different opinions. Council maybe, developers will have different opinions. Like we'll have literally, you know, it's interesting as a Planning Commission because we're all sitting side by side at this table and we see different developers come before us. And, you know, one developer tells us this is the only way you can do it. Another developer comes and says, oh, no, I can do it this way. You know, like they'll give us different bits of information and tell us why they're better at it, or ones, you know, can finance it this way versus another one. So we hear different things and we react to that. And so I would say, honestly, integration is not a settled, the definition of that is not settled. On a personal level, for me, I don't like the idea of putting groups of people isolated to where you can point and say, oh, that's the affordable housing building. I like to see us, when I think about these buildings that are going up, I mean, they're going to be here 30, 50 years. They'll be here well after I'm gone. And I want to make sure that we're building a community that we want to live in and that people don't feel segregated and they feel blended in and can have a great life.
Sure. So let's talk about Silver Creek Village. I don't know if either of you want to discuss how affordable housing is being addressed and the integration issues.
I'm sure we both could. Thomas, you want to take it?
Yeah. I mean, I think actually you probably should talk about the original spirit of because you were involved with the development agreement. But I can just say, you know, the challenge that Candace just outlined about integration and how we build affordable housing, you know, what we're talking about is, in many cases, new projects, right? And you know, when we look at something like the Canyons, for example, the affordable housing that's been approved as part of their development agreement amendment, that was, in a way, it was a complicated process, but in a way it was pretty easy because once the council and the developers got through with defining the obligation of how many beds, you know, we're talking about private land and a project that was required by the developer and privately funded. So it was pretty straightforward in terms of the Planning Commission looking at that and then saying, you know, let's try to make it as great as we can. And, you know, the things that we focused on were knowing full well that most of the housing there was going to be for resort employees, you know, circulation within the project and livability and, you know, how easy is it for employees that are going to live there to walk across the parking lot to get to the cabriolet, to get to the resort, things like that. When you get to a private development like Silver Creek Village, it's a little more complicated. The development agreement out there talked about integration as sort of an important tenet of how affordable housing is part of the overall picture out there. And that's something I think Candace can speak to because he was in the group that crafted that development agreement. But to me, what it means is a variety of types of housing for a variety of types of needs. And I think one of the things that's interesting is since I've been on the Planning Commission, we've talked about this awareness that we need affordable housing, and we know that, but we never really knew how much of what kind of what type. And so as the county has done an affordable housing study, which takes time to do and finalize, I think as Candace pointed out, we need all types of affordable housing, but we're a little closer to understanding what our most urgent needs are, and right now I think that's rental product, and that's probably where we have the biggest shortage. So as we look at Silver Creek Village, the challenge is that integration part hasn't really been defined, and as a group, I think planning commissioners don't want to see big, tall, clustered rental, as Candace said, you know.
Sure.
You can point to it and say that's the affordable housing. We wanted to see more of a blended approach with a variety of different types.
Okay. Anything quickly you want to add, Candace? We're about out of time here.
No. I would just say that, in all conversations that, at least on the Planning Commission, that I've had with my county council members and with the planning staff and honestly, even with a number of the developers, everybody's very keenly aware of this need, and it's something that everyone's focused on. And, this is the obvious statement, but there's no easy solution to it. It's going to take time, and we're going to have to work through it together. And I know that sounds almost too simple, but it's the truth of the matter is it's going to take time to work through, but we're focused on it, and it's something that we hope to be able to deal with.
Okay. Great. Thank you. That is Snyderville Commissioner Candace Hart and Thomas Cook. Thanks for joining us this morning, gentlemen. Well, yes, good morning. It is 8:32. You're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. My next guest here in the studio is Laurie Wynn. She is with the Wasatch County Children's Justice Center, and she's here to talk about Cottages for Children, this event that's coming up, I believe, this Friday and Saturday.
Absolutely.
Welcome.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for joining us. Yeah, so you've been doing this for, this is like the 17th year,
yes,
I read?
17 years.
Okay, that's, yeah. So tell us a little bit about the event for those of us who aren't familiar.
Absolutely. We hold this event at the Wasatch County Special Event Center, which is the, we affectionately call it, we call it the Pony Palace, but it's the horse arena over there on Southfields Road. This is our 17th year that we've been doing this festival, and during this festival, we have over, oh, somewhere between 100 to 200 gingerbread houses that have been lovingly made by community members, and they are donated and then silent auctioned off. We also have an amazing holiday boutique for a lot of Christmas shopping. We'll have gingerbread man cookie decorating for the kids. We have amazing entertainment, and all of the proceeds that are made during this event go to our Children's Justice Center over there in Heber City.
Okay, so who is making the houses? And when is that happening? Is that right now people are doing that?
We're really hoping that most people have their houses made at this point. If not, they'll be finishing up right before they drop them off on Thursday. But it's community members, businesses. We have a lot of government offices that make them. Our jail makes one every year for us, the inmates, which is amazing. It's always one of our showstoppers. Professional bakers. So a myriad. And right down to the little kid ones made by, you know, primary students and preschools, and it's just a really great community event.
Wow. Okay. So you've got some real standout gingerbread houses that often bring in a lot of donations.
We generally, this is our main fundraiser for the Children's Justice Center every year, and like I say, we do somewhere between 100 to 200. It just depends on the year. And there's something for every budget. A lot of the houses go for $10 to $15. Some of them go upwards of $1,000. So, yes, $1,000.
Wow. tell us a little bit about the other offerings, like the cookie decorating and the mm-hmm. boutiques. Are these local businesses that are bringing in things?
We actually do have, yes, we have a lot of local vendors that come in and do booths. Miley Walsh from over at Water for the Moon is having a booth. There's wreaths that you can buy. There's wonderful Christmas candy and fudge and shopping. Pretty much you could do all of your Christmas shopping, I believe, at this vendor booth or all the vendor booths. It's just going to be wonderful this year.
Okay.
And then entertainment for, oh gosh, we have kids singing groups, dancing groups, carolers, string quartets, you name it. It's just a whole myriad of things.
Okay. And the days are Friday and Saturday. What
Friday
are the hours?
Friday and Saturday, we have our hours are 10 to 8 on Friday, 10 to 6 p.m. on Saturday, and the judging ends or the silent auction ends for the gingerbread houses promptly at 6. And sometimes we get into bidding wars, so we have to cut it off. It's really interesting.
Okay. And so how much are you hoping to raise this year?
Somewhere between 15 and 20,000 is our goal. Okay. That just helps us support the Children's Justice Center, provide training for our the law enforcement officers that interview the kids there at our center, and just basic needs for our facility.
Okay. And anything else that people should know? Is there a fee to get in? Does it cost something?
No, it's 100% free. We will also have Christmas trees, too. We've got a couple of trees that are being donated that will be auctioned off. Not quite on the caliber of the festival of trees, but we do have local businesses that are donating trees as well. So there's really going to be something for everyone, and no fee to attend, but we'll have a couple of donation boxes set up if anyone wants to make a donation to our center.
Okay. Sounds like quite an event. And that's at 414 Southfield Road in
Correct.
Heber City. And everything from the silent auction to shopping, photos with Santa.
Absolutely. Photos with Santa Saturday afternoon.
Food, entertainment, mm-hmm. Face painting, and then just basically lots
of
fun.
Entertainment all day long.
Okay. That's great. That's Lori Wynn with the Wasatch County Children's Justice Center. Thanks for coming by, Lori.
Thank you.
Well, good morning. It is 8:38, and my next guest for the Local News Hour is Lara Carlton, Communications Manager with the U.S. Ski and Snowboard Organization. And you're going to tell us, Lara, a little bit about the weekend. It sounds like there were some significant things going on, especially in the alpine world.
Yeah, we had some really stellar results in both alpine and cross country this weekend. I'll kick it off with a report about Killington, home World Cup races for the women's tech team. We had almost 40,000 fans over the course of the weekend. On Saturday, there was a record 19,500 estimated fans watching the GS race. Michaela Schifrin, she did it again, got the four-peat in slalom on Sunday and a third place on Saturday in GS. Her slalom win is her 42nd slalom victory and her 62nd World Cup victory overall. So she's now tied for fourth in overall World Cup victories.
Yeah, okay. So, and you've listed here who she's gunning for.
Right. So she's currently tied with Austrian alpine skier Anne-Marie Moser-Prohl, and only behind Ingemar Stenmark, Lindsey Vonn, and Marcel Hirscher. So, you know, we'll just have to wait and see what happens. But she's on that trajectory for sure.
Yeah. She'll just be ticking them off, I guess.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, okay. So, so then tell us about the cross country team.
So, yeah, really awesome results for the women in the cross country races this weekend in Ruka. Sadie Mobe-Bjornsson finished fourth over on Saturday and became the first American woman ever to win the leader bib. And it was also extra special because Michaela had the leader bib at the same time. So that was the first time that an American alpine female skier and an American cross-country female skier shared the leader bib honor.
Well, that's exciting.
Yeah.
Oh, no, I was going to say, and then up next, they're in Lillehammer?
They're in Lillehammer. And also just on the cross-country side, overall, Sadie is fourth in the standings. Jessie Diggins is fifth, and Rosie Brennan is 11th overall. So we're just really excited for the momentum that team is building and hopefully will carry throughout the rest of the season.
Yeah. Okay. Anything else? We didn't really finish up on alpine. Is there anything else you want to say about the alpine team?
So the speed events for the men kicked off in Lake Louise this weekend, and Travis Ganong tied Steve Nyman for 10th in the downhill, led five Americans into the points. Travis was also 12th in Super G, so best finish for the U.S. men, and Steve got 22nd in Super G. And Jared Goldberg also tied for 30 in the downhill, another Utah native. So up next, the women head to Lake Louise for their first speed series. Jackie Wiles and Alice McInnes will make their return after being injured. And Michaela plans to ski in all three events as well, two downhills and a Super G. And from there, the women will travel to Europe. And on the men's side, this weekend is their home World Cup events at Beaver Creek, the Classic Birds of Prey event, a favorite by many on the circuit. Steve will lead the men's speed team, and Ted will lead the tech team in giant slalom, and those events are December 6th through 8th.
Okay. And then freestyle. Let's hear what's happening there.
Yeah, so freestyle team Moguls has their first World Cup event this Saturday, December 7th in Ruka. We have the strongest female team in the world, led by Jalen Koff and Tess Johnson, who both medaled at the World Championships this past February at Deer Valley, as well as Olivia Giaccio and Hannah Soar. On the men's side, Tom Rowley is coming back for a full tour since being injured, and he's skiing really well. We're excited about that. And Jesse Andringa is looking to prove himself with his brother out in due to injury this season. And we have two exciting new rookie members. Alex Lewis comes from the East Coast, and Nick Page, Park City local, he skied with Wasatch Freestyle, was coached by former team member Brian Wilson. So they'll kick things off this Saturday. And the aerials team should be jumping at the Utah Olympic Park starting this week. Finally got enough snow to get those jumps built. So we're excited for that. And, you know, obviously we have the Deer Valley World Cup this season. It's the 22nd year of freestyle competition at Deer Valley, and that will be February 6th through 8th. This is the only home event for the freestyle team and those athletes do really call Utah home. I'd say 85% of them live here year-round, so Park City support is very meaningful for them, and we're just excited for another great event.
Yeah. Okay, and then anything else with respect to the Copper Mountain Resort Grand Prix?
Yeah, so no results to report for Freeski Snowboard, but they do have some events coming up domestically. The first one is our Copper Grand Prix, which is December 11th through 14th, and that will be half-pipe skiing and snowboarding. New this season is our Big Air event at SunTrust Park. That is the Visa Big Air presented by Land Rover at SunTrust Park. And we're bringing the mountains to the Southeast's first internationally sanctioned ski snowboard event of its kind in the Southeast. So it should be a festive celebration right before Christmas. We're really excited about that. And all information can be found on our website for tuning in to any of these events, buying tickets if you would like to go see the Big Air in Atlanta. All that information is online.
Okay, that sounds great. Thank you so much for coming by. That's Lara Carlton, Communications Manager with U.S. Ski and Snowboard.
Thank you so much for having me.
Bye now. We've got our final guests in this morning, Renee Moxley-Hall and Joe Demer from the Park City Singers. Welcome. Thanks for coming by.
Well, thank you.
Let me get you going here. Okay, let's try that again. Welcome.
Thank you.
All right. So it's that time of year. Park City Singers, what, 25?
24.
24
this
years.
Year.
Okay.
Yes, next year is our silver anniversary.
Uh-huh. Okay. And let's hear a little bit about the concerts. And we've got two of them planned. One starts next week, Sunday. I should know this, shouldn't I?
You should, yes. Since you're one of our members.
I'm going to try to be objective.
Yes, Sunday, December 8th at 7 p.m. at Park City Community Church. Our second concert is Friday, December 13th, also 7 o'clock at Park City Community Church. Which, while we're speaking of the church, I'd like to say that we appreciate the relationship that we have with Park City Community Church. The church has beautiful acoustics. It will also be beautifully decorated for Christmas, not necessarily for our concert, but we benefit from that. And I'd just like to express my thanks for the relationship that we have with Park City Community Church, as well as mention that we appreciate the support from the community, which comes from the wrap tax that we receive.
Okay, and it is a hard time of the year because often the churches are very busy, booked with a lot of other activities. So to give the Park City Singers that time and that opportunity is really a great thing.
Yes, and we very much appreciate it.
So, Joe, do you want to tell us any of the treats that we can expect for those of us who are going to be coming to the concert?
Sure. We have quite a varied concert this year. We have a combination of secular and sacred pieces. We'll be singing a piece from the Handel's Messiah, Glory to God, which is a little bit one of the lesser known, not one of the ones that are most popularly sung at this time of year. We thought we would highlight that this year. We also have traditional carols in there, such as the First Noel, Angels We Have Heard on High, and God Rest You Merry Gentlemen, pieces that the community will recognize and appreciate, I think. We also have a couple of breakout groups that will sing a couple of fun songs, one about fixation on our diets at this time of the year. And so it's a fun one. And I think that the audience will enjoy that. And then also Mr. Santa, which is a kind of a parody or of sorts on Mr. Sandman. So it's the same melody, but just a different words. And And then we have a Haydn piece that we're going to close with called Achieve It Is the Glorious Work. And that's been the one that's been the most, I think, fun for everybody, but most challenging as well.
Yeah, yeah, I can attest to that. So, Renee, what else do you want to talk about? I know that there's some caroling coming up for people who might be interested. If they can't make it to the concert, maybe they can go to certain areas and hear the revelers.
Yes, in particular, we are beginning that Tuesday evening at 5:30. We do have a rehearsal that night, so we're going to sing a bit more, a bit earlier than we have in previous years, at the Skate with Santa, which occurs at Park City Ice Arena. So we'll be singing from 5:30 to 6:30 at the Skate with Santa. That's a very popular community event. They serve cocoa, I believe it is, and cookies, and Santa Claus is there, and he takes to the ice, and it's been a very fun event for us to participate in. Then we will also be singing at the Beehive Assisted Living. And this is the first time that we will be caroling also at Ballet West before the Nutcracker begins. So we'll be at the Capitol Theater in Salt Lake City. Salt Lake has not in the past had an opportunity to hear us very frequently unless they drove up here. So this gives us an opportunity to share our talent with the Salt Lake Valley. And I think that that will be an exciting event for us. And I hope that they enjoy it as well, the people that live in the valley.
And what's the date on that?
That will be Sunday, December 22nd. It is an earlier ballet. So we'll be singing beginning at 4:10.
Okay. Okay, great. Anything else that you want to say about the upcoming concert and...
Well, where they can get tickets.
Yeah.
Yes, we need to mention that. Tickets are available at SmithTix at Kimball Junction. Also online, www.parkcitysingers.org. Or from any member, including Carolyn here, any member of Park City Singers.
That's right. You can call me here at KPCW. I'm sure this is against FAA regulations, but... 6499004. I'll sell you one or two. And so just a little reminder, the rehearsals for the group starts pretty early on. I mean, we're still in summer when things start to come together. Joe, do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I start thinking actually about the music that we're going to do in June. And that's oftentimes when my wife says, go in the other room. I don't want to hear Christmas in June. and we start to look at the library that we have and then add in a couple of new pieces if we can. And the board gets together in July and we look at all of those possibilities and come up with the program. And then we have a barbecue kickoff in September, usually early September, right before our first rehearsal. And from then on, it's just, you know, hit the ground running.
Yeah. Okay. Great. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you.
Appreciate
Thanks for
that.
Having us.
That's Director Joe Demur and our own Renee Moxley Hall.